Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App Auka Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App Auka Navida downloaden und loslegen. Auka Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Cat Bailey. With me, as always, my lovely co-host, Naughty Oxford.
Hello, everybody. Glad to be here. We got our first snowfall. Not glad about that.
Oh, man, it's snowing up in Toronto.
It kind of flurried. Like, we get pretty strong squalls every so often, and it stuck for a little bit. But yeah, it was about like a centimeter, if that. And everyone's just like, boo.
Yeah, I don't miss snow very much. I like living in California where it just rains instead of snowing. So
we get both.
I don't miss the mornings at like 6 a.m. scraping my car off while running it. It's terrible.
Yeah, people who tell me, oh, I love snow. I'd love to live where there's snow. No, you wouldn't. Not if you have to work in it, because it's like, in the southern states, if there's like a dusting of snow, they shut everything down. But even in Toronto, which is known for being really wussy about snow, if there's a snowstorm, you're getting your ass to work.
Well, that is a pretty decent segue into this week's big release, which is very snow focused, and that is Horizon Zero Dawn: The Frozen Wilds. It's a DLC, obviously, for Horizon Zero Dawn. We'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk a little bit. We'll talk about our latest Final Fantasy IX report. Sorry, no Secret of Mana report again. It can be pretty hard to, when you're playing a game co-op, it can be pretty hard to make time to actually sit down together to play the game.
That makes sense, actually. I understand.
We're going to try a little segment we're calling 12 Good RPG Questions, but really quickly, first, Nadia, you're playing Etrian Odyssey 5?
Yes, I am. I bought it last weekend, and I've been kind of pecking away at it. Like, I'm just finishing up the first stratum. And, I'm enjoying it. It's funny for a game that doesn't have much of a story, and it doesn't. It still has, like, entertaining dialogue, so that's really all I can ask for.
Yeah, the characters in the village in particular are really vibrant.
Yeah, they are. They're very vibrant. They're very funny. I like how every time you go to a new level and you go back to the tavern, there's new things that people will tell you about, like the level you're on. In particular, there's a dragoon who swears his head off about every floor you visit, saying like, "Oh shit, who told me that level 2 was so easy? Oh shit, who told me level 3 was so easy?" It just goes on and on. It's funny.
A little bit of a meta awareness going on there, I think.
Yeah, it's a funny way to deliver like tips for how to get through an area.
Yeah, I wrote an article right around the time that Etrian Odyssey 5 came out that Etrian Odyssey is the best hardcore RPG that you don't know about. You were someone who didn't really know about the series.
No, I sort of knew about it by proxy because of like you and Parrish. I know Parrish is like, put it this way, I actually Googled Etrian Odyssey, the words, because I forget why, but the first suggestion that came up was Etrian Odyssey, Jeremy Parrish.
Well, so he's been advocating for it since the very beginning, going back to the days of 1UP when it first came out.
Yeah, yeah, and I can see why. It's a very satisfying little RPG, and as someone who's more story-oriented than systems-oriented, something we've talked about in the past, I still get a lot of enjoyment out of it. It's hardcore. It can be difficult, but it's not inaccessible by any means.
Yeah, when it first came out in 2007, it was very exciting, actually, because the Nintendo DS was still a relatively new experience, I think.
Right.
And it was really cool that you could map the dungeon with your touchscreen. It was a very old-school PC kind of experience. And
yeah, it is very much.
Yeah, and it was this first-person dungeon crawler, and it was like, oh, we're getting these new gaming experiences on the DS that we just have never really received on a handheld before, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially since the DS didn't really know what to do with his touchscreen at first, but that was like probably the first really good use of it.
Yeah, and then it went a little overboard on the touchscreen, didn't it?
It did. Like, I don't know if you remember Castlevania Dawn of Sorrow, where it made you draw that stupid ceiling symbol for every boss, and it was just terrible. And I love Dawn of Sorrow. It's a great game, but ugh.
Anything that made me draw was kind of annoying.
Yeah, I mean, you want to draw an Etrian Odyssey because you want to map out your area, but when you have to stop and pull out your stylus and it's totally mandatory, yeah, no.
Like with most Nintendo consoles, I didn't particularly like that they forced in the touchscreen in a lot of respects. Like, I don't know if you remember, but Ninja Gaiden used the touch, not only used the touchscreen, but I think it was played in portrait mode.
Oh, geez, I didn't play that.
Yeah.
Was that on the DS, the Wii U? I don't remember.
Really good, actually. It was a pretty solid game.
Except for the whole drawing thing.
I wasn't actually a big fan of you having to use the stylus to play Phantom Hourglass.
Yeah, that and Star Fox Command.
Yes, Star Fox Command. Oh, my gosh. Interesting game, but I would have preferred not having to use the stylus on that one. Basically, yeah. Later I learned that it was basically Star Fox 2.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? And then I play Star Fox 2, and I'm like,
well, this is familiar.
No offense to Argonaut, but this has been done already and kind of better. I'm glad that we got Star Fox 2, but...
Yeah.
But, yeah, you can see why Nintendo kind of scrapped it at the last second.
Star Fox 2 was totally worth it for the multitude of endings.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, what are the classes you're using in Etrian Odyssey 5?
Let's see, I got a Rover. I got a, a Rover, a Necromancer, a Herbalist, a Dragoon, and the Samurai ripoff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty solid party, so you're going...
It's a pretty solid party, and I think, like, I used, like, the tips that... We kind of talked about Etrian Odyssey 5 in a couple episodes ago, so I remember you saying how the Herbalist and the Necromancer both really kind of work well together as characters that cause status ailments. Like, the fact that the Necromancer can summon Wraiths for 5 MP each is kind of broken. And not only that, you can turn them into, like, firebombs. So you literally light your Wraiths on fire and throw them at enemies, which is very handy.
And they're also in the front row, so they absorb damage as well, which is huge.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually meant to ask, what is the benefit of the Dragoon's Bunker over, say, a Wraith or a Wolf?
It's just another variation of that, but it's very reliable, and you can upgrade it to be able to become more reliably take damage for you, so...
Okay, yeah, because they're pretty solid, but there's only 3 front spaces so far. I don't know if you can get more, but I tend to spend them... I spend 1 slot on my Wolf, who kind of does auto regen and healing as you go, which is really, really handy. And 2 spots for the Wraiths, who I either just have, you know, attack, or I turn them into firebombs and throw them at enemies. But Wraiths can be kind of undependable, so...
You might want to decide which you prefer, the Necromancer or the Wolf Summoner, because they're kind of redundant.
Are they really?
Yeah, because there's, like you said, there's only so many spaces, and you should really have a Dragoon up front, because, I mean, you should really have a Dragoon, because it's such a pure tank, and you really need it to absorb damage, and you could use that extra party space for DPS.
DPS?
Like, damage per second, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, you're right.
Like pure damage.
I was thinking also, like, I was thinking I should have a mage, but I didn't really know if I wanted one or not.
I don't have a mage. I think I ultimately used a pugilist, and, like, I paired a pugilist with the samurai, and then I had the herbalist, necromancer, and dragoon in the back, so.
What does the pugilist do?
The pugilist just punches people in the face.
That gets the job done, I suppose.
Yeah, it's actually pretty good. So just pure raw damage right up there in front, and pairs pretty well with the samurai. So because one of them can buff each other's damage and do additional damage, while the others are all supporting in the back. So
yeah. So I can really use more raw, like, destructive power in the party. So how far did you get?
Oh, I didn't get that far. I didn't even beat the first stratum. Like, I yeah, had no illusions about reviewing this game or beating this game.
Right.
I was just like, I am going to play as much as I can before I run out of time. I ultimately, I ended up getting totally distracted by Middle-earth Shadow of War, of all things.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
I don't even, did I talk about this last week? I don't know.
I don't know if you I know you talked about like how you didn't get through the first stratum yet because you have to start everything over once you're done with the first stratum or something like that.
No, you get to the end of the first stratum and you, I mean, you move on to the second stratum, which is,
right.
Okay, well, here are more floors to conquer, right?
Yeah.
And the core appeal, of course, is building up your party, getting stronger and stronger. Eventually unlocking those secondary classes and facing even more and greater challenges. And once you get strong enough, you can go back to the first stratum and you can take on the FOEs and suddenly they're not so tough anymore.
Yeah, I already beat a couple of those. I beat the owlbear and the giant toxipede.
Oh, I mean, hey, maybe you don't need to listen to me. Maybe what you're doing is working for you.
Well, I did try to beat like the big shrimp lobster monstrosity, and it just destroyed me.
Yeah, as they do. But yeah, so it's really satisfying going back and conquering stuff easily that gave you a lot of trouble before. So
yeah. So I'll definitely tuck away some more of it this weekend if I can.
But it's pure progression, and as much as I like Etrian Odyssey 5, I always burn out, or Etrian Odyssey in general, I always burn out by the end of the first stratum, and it even happened with me in Persona Q.
Yeah, because it's the same kind of game, right?
Same kind of game, but with way more story. And, of course, Persona, and, like, that wonderful Persona vibe, and I got kind of tired of it. But
and that soundtrack.
Let me.
Although, Etrian Odyssey 5 does have a great soundtrack.
Etrian Odyssey 5 does have an excellent soundtrack, especially the kind of the piano theme as you're walking through the forest. Very peaceful, but very dangerous.
Yeah, that's kind of what turned me on to the game at first. I was like, I'm not sure if I'm going to like this, so I'll download the demo. Thankfully, there's a really robust demo for the game. And so I'm kind of going through the menus opening in the opening minutes of the game, and I'm like, is that jazz music? Is that really smooth, calming jazz music? And yeah, it was.
It is, in fact, smooth jazz with Mike Williams.
It's totally Mike Williams music.
All right, we'll check in on with you and see if you can stay with Etrian Odyssey 5. I'm curious if you are still interested in it. Like I said, I'm kind of really distracted by Middle-earth Shadow of War for God knows why. It's like a light RPG-like substance.
Very digestible.
Because you have different equipables, right? You have a sword, you have a dagger, you have armor, you have a ring, and you can, there are variations like legendary, epic, rare, that kind of thing. And you can, there's even socketed gems that you can put in.
Oh, wow.
So you get all these gems. You can combine the gems into bigger gems that become more powerful. To upgrade your armor, you can complete challenges to make them better. And they change the appearance of your character. It's actually not terrible as thin RPG gruel goes.
So your character in Shadow of War has a ring, like as in one of the One True Rings or the ring, or
yeah, he forges his own ring at the end of Shadow of Mordor.
Wow, that is so Mary Sue. I love it.
Yeah, he forges his own ring, but it's okay because it's not in the shadow of the Dark Lord. That's why like it's powerful.
Oh, does that check out in the Tolkienverse? I have no idea.
What? No, this is just its own thing. I don't even like care about it. I'm playing it seriously because I like running around in this actually rather attractive world. I like how absurdly OP it makes you almost from the start. And I like trolling orcs. I do.
Well, yeah, I guess trolling orcs would be kind of fun.
Yeah.
They're kind of... I was never a big fan of Tolkien's orcs. They're always very one-dimensional. But since like that was the start of practically everything we know as fantasy in this day and age, I can't really blame him too much.
I had a moment just recently where I spent a lot of time trying to get this war chief into my party because one of the key tenets of this game is you can dominate captains and war chiefs and bring them into your party. But
yeah,
so he was really high level, so I shamed him down. Recruited him, made him my bodyguard. We were best of friends. He was really giant. He was crushing people. And I'm like, he would also call in buddies to help out. And I'm like, yeah, I like you. And then he betrayed me. He betrayed me, Nadia.
Oh no, the romance. What about?
And I tried to bring him back into the fold, but he had a new ability. It was Iron Will, because all of the orcs have secondary abilities as well that give them buffs and debuffs. And he like could not be recruited, so I was like, okay, I'm going to shame you until you kill yourself. So,
wow, that's savage, cat.
So I repeatedly captured him and would shame him to reduce his level because, you know, he's at like level 27. I'm like level 18 or whatever. I keep bringing him down. He was at level 7, but I couldn't catch him. I shamed him from War Chief all the way down to Captain of a Backwater Outpost.
Aw, poor guy. What'd you do? Like, how do you shame an orc? Do you pull down his pants and turn over? Like, I don't know.
Well, the way you capture them is that you do the press B when they're broken, which is you damage them enough till they're broken, and then you press B to capture them, and then you put your hand onto their face, and you are given the options of, like, command, like, recruit. You can fight to the death, or you can shame them, and shaming them, as I said, reduces their level, makes them less powerful. And so I got him down to level 7, but I had him broken, but there were too many guys around. I couldn't get to him. And then I accidentally started him on fire and he died in a flaming heat.
Whoops.
And I was like, well, that's the end of that.
That was the end of that friendship. That was really sweet for a while there.
Friendship ended with this guy. This guy is my new best friend.
Fire is my new best friend.
Yes, exactly. So that was a fun, stupid little story.
Wow, that was a story.
Yes. I like Shadow of War, but man, it annoys me how much grinding they put into it.
Yeah, and that's the whole, like, where the whole loot box controversy comes in.
It gets old really fast, because you go through the whole first half of the game, and it's kind of interesting and story-driven, and then the second, and then Act 2 is like, okay, now you can command orcs, and also you're trying to take over this fortress, and I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. And you take over the fortress and you're like, yeah, I'm awesome. And it's like, great, do it again in a new region.
And again.
You know, I think that it would have been a lot better served taking this giant fortress one of the key just things in the entire game, like building the entire game around that. Making the taking of the actual fortress the culmination of like maybe the entire game. Instead, meh.
How many fortresses do you need?
More. Yeah. I conquered a region. The army that I built is in charge of that region. Now I get to do it again.
Oh boy. Yeah, I guess that checks out if you want to conquer the world, like Alexander the Great style. But
I don't really want to. It gets repetitive real fast, and I'm already so overpowered, and I feel like I've gotten my enjoyment out of this game.
Yeah, so you've harassed enough orcs, time to move on to Pokemon.
Yes. Which...
You warmed up with orcs, time to move on to Pokemon.
Yes, it was the same thing, really, but...
Yeah.
I will be shaming them until they die.
That would be so terrible with Pokemon, can you imagine?
Shaming Pikachu till he kills himself?
Oh my god, I'm sure someone's written a fanfic like that somewhere, but yeah, that would be terrible.
Yeah, I'm not capturing you, Pikachu, I'm not adding you to my army. No, I'm just going to keep shaming you until you're the captain of a backwater outpost.
Speaking of, have you seen...
Just don't ever betray me, Nadia. That's just what I'm saying.
Don't cross Cat, everyone. You heard it here first.
No, don't cross me.
Have you seen the Zed move for Mimikyu?
I have not.
It just released today. Basically, it's called...
It's called Let's Play Forever or something like that.
Let's Play Forever, yeah. And ever and ever.
Okay, that's really freaky, given that Mimikyu is like this ghost thing.
Yeah. If you look upon Mimikyu, you die. I mean, make no bones about that.
Oh, what is the move?
Basically, he jumps up and you see his eyes kind of flash, and he basically covers the rival Pokemon with his gown or whatever you want to call it, and you just see like a bunch of thrashing, and then, well, the Pokemon dies.
Dear God.
Or faints. Yeah.
Dead.
Yeah. Dead. So it is kind of horrifying, but adorable.
Horrifying but adorable. Mimikyu already had a Z move. Why did they need a new one?
Because it's Mimikyu, damn it.
It's Mimikyu, damn it. We'll be talking about Pokemon Ultra Sun and Ultra Moon next week and having lots of things to talk about on that front. In the meantime, Horizon Zero Dawn, The Frozen Wilds, it is now out Mike did a review, which you can go read on the website. Neither of us have played it, and sorry for not bringing Mike on the show to talk about it. The screenshots are very pretty.
Yeah, it's a good-looking game. It is one of those games where you're like, you know what, I should really play this. I know I'd enjoy it, but it's a matter of finding time. I got Atrian Odyssey to play, man.
The reason I bring it up, despite not playing it, is I am curious what your thoughts are on the concept of a DLC that bolts on to the rest of the quest rather than extending the story.
I would personally rather have more story.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is more story. It's a new quest.
Well, you know, like more of a continuation of a story. The thing is, I don't know how Horizon Zero Dawn's story finishes, or if it does, or if it ends on a cliffhanger. Because if you have a story that ends on a cliffhanger, and then the DLC just bolts more story onto some jutting outcrop of the story elsewhere, that kind of pissed me off a little bit.
You know what it reminds me of?
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of the movies that you sometimes get out of animes, which are basically side stories. Like Cowboy Bebop's movie is just a side story.
Yeah, which I never saw that one. I don't know if it's any good.
Which I don't like that in particular because often they aren't very satisfying.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't really tie into the story as neatly as they could. There's a couple of exceptions. Like, there's 10 billion Dragon Ball Z movies, and I've seen a lot of them, but not all of them. Most of them are totally separate canon, but you do get occasional ones. Like, there's one that tells, like, the story of Trunks and, like, kind of goes into the future that he's in, and I love that one. That's my favorite Dragon Ball Z movie by far. But everything else I can take or leave.
The Pokemon movies have they have it down to a science.
Yes.
Every Pokemon movie has Ash meeting a brand new legendary Pokemon. Like whatever legendary Pokemon they want to push in that particular movie, like Ash ends up meeting it. He's now met like every single legendary, I'm pretty sure, and befriended them because he's Ash.
Yeah, and he can't win a friggin' like Pokemon League, but he can befriend every legendary Pokemon that ever existed.
He's met God, but he hasn't won the freaking Pokemon League.
Goes to show God hates him, I guess. No, I won't let you win anything.
My only problem is, so on the one hand, I like the idea of having more, just a new quest, right? Something new and interesting to explore. Horizon Zero Dawn's Frozen Wilds new region kind of, it's a new region and it's pretty and it's snow covered and you have new robots to kill and kind of a new side story to tell, and that really, and it adds like an extra 20 hours onto the game.
That's quite a bit. That's a lot of content.
The game was already like 40-50 hours, so it wasn't exactly short to begin with. So what it all adds up to, though, is it's the kind of stuff that you want to play organically as you're working your way through the game.
Right.
Like pretty much all of Skyrim's DLC, right? You don't necessarily go back after finishing the game to play the DLC. Same with Fallout 4.
Yeah.
You go back to, I don't know, you start a new game and then you just kind of tackle it as it comes, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's more interesting that way, I suppose. So you don't play a lot of Western RPGs, but have you encountered any DLC that you like?
It's funny because when I do play like any RPG, I usually like say, oh, I'm going to play the DLC and then never get around to it. I know that I will with Zelda, which is, there's DLC is coming out for that soon.
Yeah, I can't wait. The amiibos are out today.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah. The champion amiibos. But, God, I don't.
I want, what's her name? The Gerudo champion. She's awesome.
I want the bird.
Oh, Ravioli, or whatever his name is.
The Rito champion. I like him a lot. I like all four of them, but I got too many toys in this house. I don't. I'm feeling a little self-conscious about it, not going to lie.
Have your parents cast judgment on you? They've cast judgment on me before when they come in here at my place and I'm like, man, you could have, like, you could, like, make room for a baby if you just got rid of all the Mega Man shit.
It's more that I'm just self-conscious about, like, like, I'll look around in my apartment and go, yes, there are a few too many toys in here. So over the years, I've gone kind of out of my way to clear it all out, but so you played a fair amount of Skyrim. Did you ever do the Dawnguard DLC?
Yeah, I did some of that, And it's actually interesting. Someone brought up, I don't know who it was, but they brought up an interesting thing about, say, for example, Skyrim, the complete edition that was released the other year. It's kind of odd when you play Skyrim for the first time, just theoretically, and you hear about, oh, there's dragons everywhere, we're going to die. But then you go into Whiterun for the first time, and you start hearing about vampires because of the Dawnguard stuff, which is tacked on. So that's a little distracting, and I agree with that.
And there's also the... There's also the Morrowind DLC.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, where you go to a whole new island.
Yeah. So when you do kind of have that stuff, like from day one, that it can get quite distracting.
It's almost overwhelming in a way because exactly. All of a sudden, so you're just playing through in a natural course, and all of a sudden people just start showing up, telling you about this DLC, and you're like, am I strong enough to take on this DLC? I do not know. What is the recommended level for this?
Yeah, yeah. So it is very intimidating. And, I mean, let's face it, Skyrim is not a short game
No. In
its vanilla state.
So Witcher 3, Blood and Wine, a lot of people listed it as just one of the best RPGs of 2016 straight up because it not only extends the story, adds in an incredible new region, adds in just this really beautiful, like the fact that you can have your own vineyard and that kind of thing, and then more
awesome.
Or less wraps up the story.
Make wine, finish the story, you're good.
As usual, Witcher 3 kind of does it right, and I think the thing that I really like about Witcher 3's DLC is that it's just so different from the core game. Mm-hmm. It's really gorgeous and bright and vibrant and French. versus the kind of the core game, which is dark and Eastern European. Though I mean, obviously there are places in Eastern Europe which are really gorgeous, but yeah, you know what I mean, like Eastern European fantasy has its own vibe, right?
It really does. And it's one part of the world I'd really love to visit, because I have family from there, so
oh, it's beautiful. I've been to the Czech Republic.
Get in touch with that part of my blood.
Yeah, the Czech Republic is gorgeous, especially Prague.
Yeah, that's where my grandfather's from, the Carpathian Mountain region.
Mm, yeah, if you can ever get out to Prague, I strongly recommend it. But I suppose what I'm looking for in an DLC for an RPG like this is not only a new area that adds something new to the core game, I'm okay with a self-contained story. In fact, especially if the self-contained story is really great. Fallout 4, actually, everybody loves to malign that, but it had an amazing piece of DLC where, and pardon me, the name escapes me at the moment, but it's not Point Lookout, that's the Fallout 3 DLC, but it's in that vein, where you go to an island.
I think I remember you, talking about it. Was it something Harbor, Boston?
Far Harbor.
Something or Far Harbor, that's
yes,
it.
Yes, that's it. I think you go to Maine.
That's a Far Harbor, all right.
There's fog and monsters coming out of the fog, and
I'm all about that.
The best thing about that game was it had its own kind of self-contained little ecosystem, and it gave you so many more choices. And I think I'm you can do a lot of different things. You can make peace between the various people or whatever, and I was like, nope, the religious crazies here are legitimately dangerous. They're only going to spread. I really hate them for the most part. I'm going to kill them.
Cull them now, I suppose.
So I went and I convinced them that it was time for them to join heaven, and made them activate the core and the nuclear activate the missile in the nuclear submarine and blow themselves up.
I love how Fallout, the universe in general, has been like just decimated by nuclear war, but there's still all these nuclear toys running or like lying around that you can like fuck around with, like the Megaton, which I never blew up. I know a lot of people blew up Megaton, but I never did it.
It'll be like 1,000 years after we're dead, but people will stumble upon a cache of nuclear weapons and go, "What are these?"
Oh, it's like The Stand. I don't know if you ever read that or
I did.
Saw it.
I did in fact read The Stand.
Yeah,
good book. Gets a little slow in the end.
Yeah, but we all know how it ends.
Yes, exactly.
So it's pretty much what you just talked about.
Mass Effect 2, interestingly, it has a lot of different DLC. Lair of the Shadow Broker is one of the most celebrated ones, and that tells a kind of interesting story where So one of the main characters through the entire story, and once again, forgive me, I don't remember, Blue Girl, the Asari, she is not a huge participant in Mass Effect 2, which is kind of a drag if you dated her in Mass Effect 1. But she's kind of come into her own in Mass Effect 2. And then in the DLC, you team up with her, and suddenly she's like a full-blown badass. And they take the time to do a lot of cool things in that game. There's a flying car chase, kind of a la Attack of the Clones.
Nice.
There's a bit where you're on top of a ship, and then there's this wind that's going to be blowing you off. The boss battle's really good. It's just a great, great piece of DLC. One really fantastic piece of self-contained content.
Yeah, it's always good to have that like self-contained story. Because what we were just talking about with Skyrim, like that gets really confusing when like people are telling you all about the DLC and you're like, I don't know what this has to do with what I with my main quest.
I never had any particular interest in becoming a vampire, so I never really engaged with
vampires. Vampires suck, so to speak.
Yeah, they're not very good. Being a vampire in Skyrim is kind of the worst.
Yeah, werewolves all the way, baby.
Yeah, werewolves are the best. Are you kidding me? It's like unfairly good.
Oh, I know. Like so many of my girlfriends are in love with Farkas too.
You get really ugly if you're a vampire in Dawnguard.
You do, don't you? Like, damn, no, thank you.
I'm trying to remember. It's almost a little like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where if you become an At first, you're kind of the handsome, sexy vampire, but as you get older and older, you eventually become like the master, where you just become almost like this weird corpse thing, these like really gross long fingers and all that stuff.
Well, at least you don't sparkle.
At least.
There you go, a Twilight joke, really timely.
Welcome to 2009, Nadia.
I read all those books, you know, I'm an idiot.
It's funny because I'm watching Parks and Rec right now, which is firmly set in 2009, complete with all of the jokes. And I'm like, oh God, I remember that. Oh God, I remember that. Oh God.
Yeah, you think it's like 2009 wasn't that long ago. Oh, no, it kind of was.
So one more thing about DLC that kind of bolts onto the main game. It can kind of throw the weapon balance out of whack a little bit.
Yeah, I guess, do you mean if you find, like, a powerful weapon, like, meant for the DLC, and you bring it back into the main timeline?
Yes.
Yeah, I could see how that could screw things up a bit.
Just a little bit, so.
So, yeah, DLC in general, I suppose, can kind of throw balance out of whack if the game's not careful.
Because expansions, by their very nature, are meant to be worth your money, right? So.
Yeah.
Especially if they're a fairly large expansion, like the Horizon Zero Dawn Frozen Waste DLC. And so they're going, well, we want to make it worth their while by giving them really good stuff for participating. And so often the weapons end up being just really crazy OP, and then you can just run through the rest of the game, and that's maybe not as satisfying, I don't think. But yeah, I was mentioning Mass Effect 2 earlier. One of the interesting things they did was they made the final piece of DLC a lead-in to Mass Effect 3. Yeah, which can be maybe a useful approach if you are doing a trilogy and you know it.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of the kind of thing I like, even though I know it's really a blatant commercial for the next game. Just that I like bridges.
Yeah. I think it's kind of tough to bolt on DLC to the end of the game, because I'm betting that they probably have internal metrics on how many people actually end up finishing the game, and it's actually not that high.
Yeah, if you ever look at like your friends' trophies or achievements, especially trophies, you can see like, you know, here's the trophy for the end of the game, and you can see how many of your friends got it or how many people got it in general. And more often than not, the trophy you get for finishing a game is in the rare or very rare category.
Yeah, it definitely is, because people run out of time, they get other games, they get literally to the final mission and go, oh, I'll finish this later, and then never get around to it.
And, yeah.
So endgame DLC... That's the problem, is that if you do endgame DLC, then plenty of people will be like, well, I haven't finished it, so I'm not going to buy it.
Yeah. No, you're right about that. I never thought about that, but you got a point there.
And of course, if you have just the regular DLC, that makes it makes the inevitable Game of the Year edition all that much more enticing.
There you go.
because then you can get all the DLC together and it's like, oh, look at this. I got this big old game now. So, and way more content than I would have gotten at launch.
And I'll play it all, I'm sure.
Yes. So go check out Mike's Horizon Zero Dawn Frozen Wastes review over on the site. Frozen Wastes. I don't know. I guess that's
Frozen
how,
W's.
I guess that's how I kind of see Horizon Zero Dawn in my mind. Frozen Wastes.
Frozen Wasteland.
He talks a bit about he gives a pretty solid overview of what you can expect from it and how it relates to the rest of the core content. And also you can stare at lots of very pretty pictures, because if there's one thing that Horizon Zero Dawn does right, it's photo mode.
Oh yeah, it's a very pretty looking game.
Yeah. So, okay. Nadia, let's just skip right on to the Final Fantasy IX report. All right, we're running out of time, so we are going to skip the 12 good RPG questions. Keep that for a rainy day. So if you want to submit some questions of your own, I'm really curious. We're kind of doing it in an either-or format. So, but let's move on to the Final Fantasy IX report. I think this is number 8. And Nadia, we are getting dangerously close to the end. Run me through what has happened since we last played.
Well, basically, if I recall correctly, when we left off last time, Kuja had kidnapped my party.
Gasp.
And said to, what's his face, Zidane, hey, go get this Glug-Ug stone for me. And it's in the desert palace. So Zidane says, okay, yeah, I'll do that. So Zidane goes to the desert palace, gets the stone. I'll complain about the desert palace later. And brings back the stone. Kuja is like, you know, takes off as usual. And I actually ended up rescuing Cid's wife, because she was being held captive in this palace, it turns out. So I retrieved her and I got the airship. And now I am on my way to, apparently there is a castle that links Kuja's world to Zidane's world, because apparently Kuja lives on quote unquote Terra. And the world I'm on in Final Fantasy IX is called Gaia. So, that's an interesting...
how very Final Fantasy 13.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. But yeah, so I've got an airship. Hooray!
Hooray, you did it! The Hildegard 3.
Yes, the Hildegard 3.
More than one airship. There are many airships in this game.
Yeah, at least they number them. I think we talked about last time about how Final Fantasy IV had airships littered all over the map.
They look pretty badass, though. I really like the design of the Hildegard 3.
It's really nice. It's a pretty cool airship. I mean, let's face it, the Final Fantasy IV's airships are just regular ships with propellers attached to them.
For the most part, yes. They got a lot sleeker going into Final Fantasy VI, Final Fantasy VII. Mm-hmm. It became a little freaking spaceship in Final Fantasy VIII.
Yeah, that's right.
The worst thing I always hated was that in 10 it was just a menu system.
Was it? I don't know if I got that far in 10. Maybe I should do a 10 report.
You never finished 10? Wow.
I never finished 10.
Jeez. Well, so you never finished 8, 9, or 10.
Yeah, but 8 I didn't like, so
Nadia.
I have a reason for that.
Nadia. Nadia.
No, the only thing I like about 8 is Laguna.
Nadia. Okay. All right, let's keep going. Let's start with the Desert Palace, which you said you're not a big fan of.
Oh, it's so pretentious, like Kuja.
Pretentious.
I guess that's a good way to... They mirror each other perfectly. Here's the problem I have with the Desert Palace. Final Fantasy IX, my main complaint about it is that the dungeons are hard to get through because, again, the backgrounds don't always show you where you can go. And I really, really wish that they had put that thing in Final Fantasy, what they have in Final Fantasy VII, where you press the select button and you see where the exits are. That's all I'm asking for. But with the Desert Palace, not only is it kind of hard to tell your way around, but also something about the hit detection with the... Like, you're supposed to trigger a bunch of candelabras to get anywhere in the stupid palace. And something about the hit detection for those candelabras is off. Like, if you get a prompt that says, hey, you can push this, like, it kind of flickers. It's there and it's gone. Like, you don't even know if you saw it. It's not very solid. I just had a really hard time getting through that palace. I had to consult an FAQ to see what I was doing, where I was going. I actually said on Twitter, I don't know who designed this palace, but I hope they went to video game jail.
It was Hironobu Sakaguchi. No,
come on, Sakaguchi. And not only that, the hints they give you, because there's a bunch of obtuse puzzles everywhere in this stupid place, and the hints they give you, the clues are all written like all like deep and fancy and like Evangelion anime bullshit. I can't even understand what it was trying to tell me about angels and demons and I just did not have fun. And to make things worse, the enemies in that palace, there are certain enemies that kind of shuffle between like a physical weakness and a magical weakness, and if you hit the wrong weakness, they'll destroy you.
Mm-hmm.
So with a bad counterattack. So I was really glad to get through that palace. There were a couple of interesting story reveals, like apparently there was a civilization on the planet that is gone now, and they left behind like a record of their achievements, I suppose, in this desert palace, and they kind of talked to you a little bit about that and what they're all about, but I didn't quite understand it fully yet. I'm supposing like these are gaps that have to be filled in as you get closer to the end of the game. So long story short, to hell with the desert palace.
To hell with the desert palace. So a few things. So you have Cid with you in this one.
Yeah. Yep. Cid's a human now.
Well, yeah, he's a frog in the desert palace still.
He was a frog in the... Oh, that's right. And there's that stupid minigame with him, too, where he had to, like, creep up on a hedgehog pie and grab the key. Screw that game, too.
Yeah, it was pretty it looked pretty annoying. So I was watching the Let's Play of it, and I'm just like, oh, God. I have vague recollections of this, and I remember being really annoyed by it.
Yeah, and you have a timer, of course, because of course you do.
You have the timer because he's turning around. He has his back turned on you, but he'll, like, periodically turn around. And if you mess up and he sees you, he will be like, rah, rah, rah. But of course, you have to you have to beat the timer, too.
Yeah, of course. Of course, you have to beat the timer because you just got it. And then it's funny, you re-enter the room later as like a fully grown human again when you get Zidan back. And the hedgehog pie is gone. And the FAQ I read said, like, maybe the Moogle in the room ate him. Because there's a save Moogle in the room.
And then you're also doing other puzzles with Cid as well, right?
I'm trying to remember. Yes, that's right. The weights. The stupid, stupid weights.
Yeah, I don't understand the weights. Can you explain them to me?
I don't even know because, you know what? When I finally finished that stupid thing with the key, I had a minute left and I said, I am not screwing with this. And I looked up the answer. But basically, you have to balance the weights so that one side is higher up, one side is lower down, and Cid can use that to jump up and hit the timer, the hourglass timer that's supposed to save everyone and release them from captivity because, of course, Kujo being all evil and stuff, he promises, oh yeah, your friends will be safe. But then he starts kind of slowly opening the floors below their cells, and of course there's lava below there, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah.
I think there are two reasons that they went about this approach with the Desert Palace. One is, I think the tech was fairly settled at that point, so they could focus a lot more on the actual design. And so they were having a lot of fun. Maybe too much fun.
Maybe a little too much fun, yeah.
And I think it was also a response to the criticism that was leveled at Final Fantasy VIII and to a lesser extent 9, or sorry, 7 and 8, where people were like, oh, the dungeons in Final Fantasy VII are just a corridor.
Well, yeah, but that's okay.
Is it?
I find, well, I don't know. Final Fantasy doesn't always excel at puzzles. When I think puzzle RPG, I think Zelda, I think, you know, Lufia. I don't really think Final Fantasy quite as much. When I do think of puzzles in Final Fantasy, I think more about, like, say, for example, Final Fantasy VI, where you had to divide your party into three several times to hit switches for each other. That was kind of neat, even though it frustrated me as a kid. Now that I'm older, I appreciate that. But if you're going to throw puzzles at me, don't make them obtuse, number one. Translate them properly, number two. Number three, give me some hit detection that works. Let me know what I can touch and what I can't touch.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally fair. And in general, the thing that was always frustrating about Final Fantasy's puzzles, and it was a similar problem that I have with Pokemon, actually, is that really you're just wandering around hitting switches, and it's meant to be time-consuming. And in the process, you have to fight random battles. And if there's one thing that drives me crazy, it's... Okay, I'm walking along. Oh, good, another random battle. Sweet, another random battle. Oh boy, another random battle. What was I doing again? I'm pushing this boulder, and here comes a random battle.
I think it was, I looked up the LP, on lparchive.org for this particular part of the game. And basically the person who was playing the game labeled it, "I hate this dungeon, fuck this dungeon." And that was the name of that whole area of the playthrough.
Okay, that's fair
and
enough.
I'm like, yeah, I feel you, buddy. I feel you.
Yeah, I think the thing is that I think you kind of hit the nail on the head that it's really obtuse. It's mm-hmm. not... they went a little overboard with the puzzle design. Like, they were going, well, so many other previous Final Fantasies was just wandering around hitting switches, so how can we make this more interesting? I don't know, we'll have this really crazy weight minigame.
It had this weight minigame, and not only that, it's like the candle... There's a part where you have to open up a door by lighting all the candelabras at the same time, and of course, one candelabra turns off one door, or one lights up another door. It's and the main problem I have with that, too, is you have to watch the animation every single time, like the character lighting the stupid candelabra. And that adds up.
Adds up just a little bit in terms of time. I think the thing with this is also that it's kind of a long dungeon. Like, it really overstays its welcome, right?
It really does. And it's not so much the dungeon that's long, it's that there's so much backtracking and trying to figure out where you're going. And, again, the random encounters, the battles are not easy ones you can blow through. It's just bleh.
And also the random encounter, like the hit rate is fairly high, or the random encounter rate in the original game is fairly high, and it takes forever to load into a random encounter.
Of course, yeah. Thankfully, you know what, at one point I just said, screw this, and I turned off random encounters. I said, I'm not going through this anymore. I've earned my keep. I've earned this turn off.
So I don't remember this dungeon like at all, but I do remember getting, but when I was watching it, I suddenly started getting heartburned. And so I'm like, interesting. When I was watching Cid sneaking up on the whatever the heck thing that you were talking about, I started getting heartburn and having PTSD flashbacks.
Yeah.
And so
dungeon PTSD.
I must have played this, hated it, and totally wiped it from my mind.
Yeah, yeah. Don't you love it when you replay a game? You're like, oh, I love this game. I'm going to have a lot of fun replaying this. And you get to a part and you're like, oh right,
that part. Oh, God. The part where you always go, oh, God, I'm just going to have to hold my nose and suffer through this part. Oh, thank God it's over.
Thankfully, really, like the new additions to the PlayStation and Steam version of the game helped a lot. I don't know what I would have done without them.
The example of that for me is in Xenogears, when you're climbing up the Tower of Babel and you have to platform and you have to hit. And first of all, the platforming ain't very good. And second of all, you have to hit it precisely. And if you don't, you fall all the way back down to the bottom of the dungeon. And you have to do all of the random encounters again. And the encounter rate is fairly high. And that was so traumatic that to this day, I'm just like, fuck that part. Pardon my language. I was not like, a big fan.
That's like me and Breath of Fire 3. I don't know if have you played 3? I don't think you have.
I haven't played a single Breath of Fire game, Nadia.
Maybe that should be our next report.
Oh, God.
But there's a dungeon in Breath of Fire 3 called Angel Tower where you have to push blocks, and it's really hard to push blocks from an isometric perspective. It's not fun.
Yeah, no. Any game that tackles on that kind of stuff just annoys the heck out of me. I always thought Chrono Trigger got it just right in terms of being able to do the puzzles. They were light and enjoyable and not too time-consuming, and because it didn't have the random encounters, it wasn't a chore.
Yeah, exactly.
I always say, the victory road in Pokemon was always the worst example of this, because it's moving all of the stones around and using every single one of your HMs and wanting to kill everybody. Yeah. And thank God they got rid of HMs in Pokemon Sun and Moon, so it wasn't as much of a big deal.
When I think of horrible Pokemon puzzles, I think it was Team Rocket's hideout where you had those stupid conveyor belt floors. And it was hilarious to watch Twitch play Pokemon trying to get through that part. Like, I think it took them days.
Literally days.
It took days.
The worst part, I think the worst victory road was in Pokemon Ruby and Sapphire, where you go through this really long victory road. And then when you get to the end, as a one big middle finger to you, it has the hardest single trainer battle in the entire game.
Which one was that again?
When you take on, he starts off, I forget what his name is, but when you first meet him, He's this weak, sickly boy. I think his name is Wally?
Walt. Yeah, and he has that stupid mushroom thing.
Yes, and he...
Raltz.
And he captures a Raltz, and you're like, good for you.
Aw,
and you periodically meet him. And then when you meet him in Victory Road, he's this uber-powerful trainer. And you have to get into this really hard battle. And if you haven't... And if you've used all of your potions and things to get through Victory Road, because the elite trainers and everything will really drain your levels and everything, you're going to have a hard freaking time. And then if you lose, you have to go all the way back.
Oh, my God. That's hilarious. That's a great troll from the developers.
Yeah, so if you didn't save, and you probably didn't save beforehand, you're screwed.
That's amazing.
Yeah, because you probably don't even know, because you're like, aha, the entrance, the exit, at last. I am so, God, no.
Can't you tell the kid to show off? Like, hey, come on, I did you a favor.
And actually, I don't think you can just save in the middle of the game in Ruby and Sapphire. I think you have to go to a PC or something like that to save your game.
Oh, really? I thought Pokemon, like in the first one, you could just save whenever you wanted. It was really handy.
I don't remember. But in any case... Even if you can, you probably didn't, because you just saw the exit. And you're like, I'm good. I'm safe. I'm, oh, God, no. Yeah, it was me.
No, just kidding.
But I digress. You also fight Zorn and Thorn in this the Desert Palace, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
And they go full Cronenbergian on you.
Yeah, that was a thing, wasn't it? Like, what's his name? Kuja is like, oh, well, you know, you can... hang out with the twins for a while, but the way I hear it, they're not twins. And they turn to this like huge monstrosity that is just fused, and it's like, oh God. And that really loves status ailments.
Don't you love those status ailment bosses?
There's like, I don't know what status ailment it is in particular, but there's a status ailment that freezes your character, poisons them, and saps their MP, and it's really terrible.
That is really terrible.
Yeah.
Did you have a hard time with them?
I had a bit of a time, but it wasn't too bad. I think I'm a little bit OP because I don't run away from too many battles.
Okay.
And let's face it, with Final Fantasy IX, if you know what you're getting into and you equip the right abilities, you're usually okay.
Yeah, well, be careful, because the bosses in the final dungeon are... If you're underleveled, they're going to probably kill you. So make sure that you're at the right level. You'll know. You will know if you're underleveled, because the first time I played through Final Fantasy IX, they kind of kicked my ass. So, but
yeah, but I'm the idiot who went through the after years and went through every floor of the Final Moon dungeon, and that game at the end is just loaded with like all the uber bosses from all the previous Final Fantasy games. So I managed that somehow for some reason.
Yeah, Zorn and Thorn, very Rick and Morty, kind of freaking me out. There is a great parody of a 90s commercial. I don't know if you ever saw this, but three kids drink this power juice and turn into the energy juice and fly off, and they are rapping together, and they arrive at their mom's house, but when they appear, they're this horrible mixed up Cronenberg monster, Rick and Morty style, and then the rest of the commercial is them fighting and trying to kill it.
Yeah, that was great.
Kill it with fire.
So that Zorn and Thorn in a nutshell right there.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, no, and the design of that boss is very kill it with fire.
Oh, yeah. It's there aren't too many horrors in Final Fantasy IX, but that thing was a horror.
That was absolutely a horror. And thank God you don't see them come together. It just goes straight into the battle. But
yeah,
you can kind of imagine it.
It's kind of reminded me a little bit of like Final Fantasy Final Fantasy VII with the Genovas, where they were obviously meant to be monstrosities, but they were more like triangles put together, and you said, okay, Square, good job, I see what you're going for.
Yes, exactly.
But no, they look pretty freaky in 9.
So you finally get out of the Desert Palace, you get the airship, thank God, you meet Hilda.
Yeah, I met Hilda. She was nice. I liked her.
Sid is like, please, God, turn me back into a human. Oh, help. I'm sick of being a bug or a frog or whatever.
Yeah, they reconciled. That was sweet. I liked that scene. She said Kuja basically spilled his entire plan to her. Do they say why? Like, or is it just like something he did because he was overconfident and bored?
Yes, exactly. So, and now you have the airship, and you get to wander around a little bit, except no.
I actually did wander around a little bit because I went to the Black Mage Village and kind of like talked to them again because they were all like feeling kind of ripped off and remorseful because they basically partnered with Kuja because Kuja promised, oh, I'll extend your lifespans. And of course, once they joined up, Kuja said, haha, I lied. I can't do shit for you and I won't do shit for you. So they all went back home, and that was kind of sad because they kind of had to realize they're going to die, number one, and number two, you know, they may as well just die where they're happy, which is their village. So.
Sad. Jeez, how tragic.
Yeah. The baby chocobo hatched.
Yay!
They were looking after a baby chocobo egg, and it was really cute.
The circle of life. New life. Life is renewed, and it is good. Memo to villains, keep your promises.
Yeah, come on, dudes. Like, Kuja's so boring. I'll probably get more into that with the written Final Fantasy Now report, and once I see if he actually has anything to him. By the way, I did go through Mount Glug-Glug.
Glug-Glug.
However you pronounce that.
Yes.
I love the music for there. That's like a remake of the Final Fantasy I music. Mm. That was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think of the mountain and the events that happened there?
I think that's actually where I wound up fighting Zorn and Thorn, if I recall correctly. Mm. I thought I fought them in the Desert Palace, but no, I got confused. I liked that dungeon. Again, I got a little confused with where I was going, but once I figured it out, that was a little freaky too, because that's the area where there's all these red dragons, and they just jump scare you.
Oh, right. Yeah, that is totally a thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And you're like, you're kind of creeping into a room like, is there going to be a red dragon here? Is there going to be a red dragon here? Oh God, there it is. So... Yeah, I beat up the red dragons. They were trying to... I think Zorn and Thorn were trying to extract Eiko's Eidolons.
Ah, yes.
And yeah, that's right. Her guardian Mog, literally named Mog, turned into a big-ass Eidolon and basically saved her life. And this is really interesting. I think the Eidolon that Mog turned into is named Medin, which is the name of Terra's father in Final Fantasy VI.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's
Although
a reference.
It was translated in the original translation as, I think, Maduin or something like that, but his name is Medin in Japan.
So it culminates with Dagger, now Garnet, now called Dagger, because she has a dagger that helped her make various decisions. I don't know if I would trust my decision-making to a knife myself.
I would.
She decides to, she does something pretty momentous. And how did you feel as you watched it?
Oh, yeah, that's right. She basically cuts off her hair, which is a very anime / video game JRPG thing that a lot of female characters do. Like, I remember seeing, of course, a lot of us probably first saw it in Mulan, or I think it also happened in Princess Mononoke. Although it wasn't San who did it, it was the male character. The first place I saw that, I think, was in Wild Arms. Cecilia, the female character, she's a princess, and she cuts off her hair. And as I understand it, it's a very sort of Japanese thing, isn't it? Kind of severing your ties to family and royalty in particular. So she did that. Changes her portrait, which I really like. I think that was great. Her character portrait.
Great.
So yeah,
and it gets its own cutscene, too, fully animated and everything.
So. Yeah, that was a really nicely done cutscene. Yeah, I actually like that part. And her hair all blew away.
It's meant to empower her. And now she is empowered. She has kind of found her. I mean, she's kind of come full circle as a character. I don't know if you would say that she's completed her arc, but she's kind of found what she's looking for, I would say.
Yeah, like she's basically found her direction because for a while there, she lost her voice after her mother died. And she returned to Alexandria and kind of visited her mother's grave and determined, well, you know, I'm the one, I have to be the princess of this place. I have to take over, but first I have to make things right. The people have to see I have strength. So that's part of why she cut her hair, kind of to just, I don't know if the word is bring herself down, but kind of ground herself, I suppose. And so, yeah, she's part of the party now for good. And she got her voice back, so she won't just suddenly start randomly failing in battle again.
The other subtext, of course, is when you're cutting off your hair, you're inherently making yourself more masculine because men have shorter hair. And so, and we associate masculinity with strength. So she is becoming more masculine, which is a signal to she's becoming more powerful.
Yeah, that's There's that too.
Yes.
Well, cutting my hair was the best decision I ever made in my life.
Oh God, my girlfriend cut her hair, and I'm so jealous.
Why don't you cut yours?
Because I don't think I would look very good with short hair.
I didn't think so either. But I used to have hair down to my butt when I was born. I had hair down to my shoulders. It was ridiculous.
What?
So my mom kept my hair long when I was through my girlhood. But here's the thing: I had long hair, but I have very thin hair. I actually have alopecia, and so I just lopped it off. Best decision I ever made in my life. I've tried to grow it again. It was terrible. I said, nope, never again. Short hair forever. Thank you.
I had short hair in high school, and because I, I think everybody goes through that phase, and I grew it out again in college and never looked back because I didn't particularly like how I looked. And also, I think my hair is my best trait. Because
you have very nice hair.
Thank you. It's very thick and naturally wavy. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
So I'm kind of reluctant to get rid of it, but
yeah, no, you have nice hair. Like I said, my hair was very thin. In my mother's side of the family, like my aunt, my grand, my both my aunts actually all have very thin hair, so I inherited that, lucky me.
Though if you want to make a point and cut off your hair, I wouldn't necessarily recommend doing it with a dagger. Maybe go to a stylist dagger.
Go to stylist and say, here, use this. Give him a dagger. I'd kind of want to do that, though. Like, they make it look so easy and so smooth and look so nice when it's done. But in reality, of course, if you cut your hair with a dagger, it's going to look like shit.
No, she's going to wake up in the morning and be staring in the mirror and be like, oh, God, it's so ragged. Ah.
It's like when I was a dog groomer and we'd have people who'd bring in their dogs after giving them their own haircuts. Could you save this? Could you save my dog? I'm going to have to now, aren't I?
I hope for her sake that must have been a really sharp dagger, because I imagine I've never tried to cut my hair off with a knife, but I imagine that it would require a fair amount of chopping.
Again, when I was a groomer, like, there was always this stage that people would go through when grooming school where they'd take their own clippers to their own hair just because, and it happened all the time, and yeah, it's just one of those rite of passages, I suppose.
I think Garnett is my favorite heroine.
She's pretty cool. I like her. And one reason why, and I said this in my written report, everyone should go back and read it, is because she does kind of do that tropey thing where she's like, hey, I want to come too. And they say, no, you can't do that. And she just takes off on her own. And I like that because I am so sick of the cliche where the female character whines and moans and, like, you know, just sneaks in with the party anyway or forces her way in. But Garnett's like, no, you know what? You don't want to help me. I'm doing my own thing. I'm doing it my own way. And she did.
Well, she definitely has her own arc, and she's a well-developed character. And aside from the whole cutting off her hair thing, for the most part, she's much more feminine than, say, she begins as like a princess, and she doesn't really move away from being feminine, but she's still like really strong in like her own way, which I think is pretty cool. And looking back on the whole history of Final Fantasy characters, like Final Fantasy protagonists, I obviously Celeste is really cool. I never really particularly cared for Tifa or Aeris.
No, I was never a fan of either of them, or Yuffie, for that matter.
Yuffie was just fun, but in a very kind of prototypical anime kind of way.
Exactly.
Rinoa, I don't even know what the heck was going through her mind when she was looking at Squall. I guess maybe he's hot.
He's hot with his low poly face.
I like her dog.
She had a nice dog, Angelo. I remember the dog. He was a good dog.
I like Selfie is fun and very self-actualized.
She just
like whatever. She doesn't care. She's on her own thing. And Quistis is boring. And so
Quistis is every fanboy's dream.
Yeah, Quistis really is a fanboy's dream. And then so you get into 9, and out of all of them, she's not a background character. She has her own arc. She probably comes the closest to matching Celeste just as a great. Yeah. Great, great character. And then, you know, looking ahead to the Final Fantasies that followed, I guess Yuna's okay.
Yuna's okay. Lightning, even though I don't like 13, I have no interest in it whatsoever, I do appreciate that we had, like, a stoic kind of strong female lead.
The problem with Lightning is that she was a very one-dimensional character. And she was doing the whole big sister thing. And they just basically, her personality was as the plot demanded and just changed wildly from game to game, essentially, until she became like a god or something.
Or something happened.
Yeah, so it didn't even really matter in the end. She was just a vessel for you to be like, yep, she's female Cloud, all right.
Yep, that's a good way to describe her. I liked Fran in 12.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, she was a little more background, but I did like her. I liked the relationship she had with what's his name? Why am I blanking on his name? He's the best character in the game. Mm. But I liked the relationship she
Baltiar.
Had with him.
Fran is very quiet, and very much a secondary character. But, I mean, she's cool.
When she speaks, she has something really interesting to say. I still love... The one line out of her I loved was just, like, when Vaughn is says to Balthier, like, you know, please take me over to my friend. She's been kidnapped, blah, 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 blah. And, like, basically he's, like, recruiting them, even though they're ready to go on their own... Fran and Balthier are ready to go on their own direction. Fran's just like, the gods are toying with us. I just love how dryly she delivers it.
But I think the thing that really stands out to me with Garnett is, much like Celeste, she is the co-star of the story. You could even argue that this game is her game. And she is certainly one of the very core characters, along with Vivi and Zidane. So, and you can't actually say that as much about other Final Fantasies. Even, like, Yuna was certainly a huge part of Final Fantasy X, but she was also... I mean, Tidus was absolutely the star of that game.
Yeah.
He was front and center. All of the hang-ups and everything were kind of about him.
Issues.
All the daddy issues were very much about him. The final boss was about him, for God's sake.
Yeah.
And, Yuna's choice was a huge part of that game, but she was also the love interest, where Garnett is on her own journey independent of any romantic feelings with Zidane, so...
Yeah, I mean, they're there, and that's one thing I also liked about 6, is that Locke and Celeste were in love, but it was very, very subtle.
Mm-hmm.
And there was definitely a subquest where Locke had to get rid of his past issues before he could really accept the fact that he was in love with Celeste. And I just love the way they did that. And it's kind of the same thing going on with 9, where, yes, there's something there, but each character has their issues to work through before they can really admit much.
All right, so we're running out of time here, but so we're going to wrap up now. Nadia, what can we look forward to? What are you going to be doing? And any final thoughts?
Well, I'm going to keep playing Final Fantasy IX, of course. I just wrote the fourth part of my written report, which was a big one. You should go back and read that. I think it's pretty good. I kind of talk a little bit about Garnet's past, because that's one thing we didn't touch on in this episode, but I talk about her past and basically what her adopted family did versus her biological family. So, look into that.
Yes, it's a nice little companion to the podcast. You can find that on the site, usgamer.net. Okay, Nadia, as always, we have comments from the previous episode. Last week, we talked about the Xbox, and it's kind of interesting history with RPGs and what they meant to Western RPGs and that such. We forgot a game, and I mentioned this in the show notes, and I felt a little embarrassed. We totally forgot about Fable.
Oh, dear. Yeah, that's right. We turned off Skype, and we're like, shit, we forgot about Fable, didn't we?
That was kind of a major one, wasn't it?
Just a small thing, yes.
Yeah, my problem with Fable was that it was always broken promises, and Fable 2 was the best of them, but at the end of the day, it wasn't that interesting, I don't think. Mm-hmm. And Fable 3 just annoyed the crap out of me with how it was such an interesting idea that was so... It was a great example of gameplay mechanics totally breaking the story. The moral was really dumb. They're going...
Yeah, wasn't that like...
Yeah?
Kind of like just a very all-or-nothing game where they promise you can make choices and then... Your choices aren't very choicey.
Well, the kicker is you lead the revolution to take over the kingdom. Great. Well, then you find out that an evil enemy is coming in and you need as much money as possible to save your kingdom. Okay, that's interesting. And so you can get money by doing quests, buying up real estate, whatever. That's cool. But actually, what you do is you buy up tons of real estate, and because the story only advances when you decide to advance it, but time also is still going...
Oh, right.
You can literally just put the controller down and wait for your treasury to fill up from the constant money rolling in from real estate. And then it just makes whatever heck moral you're doing completely moot. Because it's like asking you just a, oh, well, you can side with the greedy industrialists, but you're going to make everybody unhappy. But you'll get the money needed to save the kingdom. Are you going to be a horrible tyrant and save everybody? Or are you going to be really nice and let everybody die? Oh, actually, you can just become a real estate mogul.
I wish I could do that in real life. Put down the controller, wait for my bank account to fill up.
Yeah, that would be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I should put aside the controller and wait for my bank account to fill up. That might be actually the right answer. Nimsy says, I remember when the first Fable came out and the concept that your character could change based on how you played was introduced. Up until that point, game characters had always been static entities to me. That's true. Of course, that was a very JRPG thing to be a static entity. Western RPGs, they wouldn't change. They would change a fair amount, I believe. Yeah.
Well, actually, Mega Man Legends, it's not like a JRPG, but that was a game where it would change a lot depending on, especially 2, it would change a lot depending on how you acted. You could get townspeople to just hate you. If you went around destroying their property, kicking their dogs and their pigs,
don't kick
you
could pigs, get rolled. Nadia. Don't kick pigs.
But they would bounce. That was my problem. Like, I kicked a pig and started bouncing. I'm like, holy crap, that's amazing. And I kicked the pig over and over, and next thing I know, my armor's black. I'm like, oh, shit.
So, we were lamenting the loss of Lost Odyssey. Well, it's actually an Xbox backwards compatible game.
Yeah, I should play that.
And that might be a really good subject for a report, though my understanding it's quite long.
Yeah, see, you'd give me an excuse if it's not my Xbox.
Yes, it's right there. I'm Xbox One backwards compatibility. So, thanks to everybody who reminded us of that. Bobby Watson says, Lost Odyssey is the main reason why I got an Xbox 360 way before I even ever bought a PS3. It's a shame this game was never ported to anything. For what it's worth, I liked it a lot more than 13 and 15. It really felt like an evolution of 7 and 8 more than any Final Fantasy game that came after it. Bobby Watson also sings the praises of Infinite Undiscovery, another game we didn't talk about, which, oh man, that game got savaged. by reviews back in the day. It was a really messy game. Maybe the kind of the fall of Tri-Ace.
Mm-hmm.
And they mentioned that they found Japanese imports of green tea Kit Kats in a U.S. store. So when they were traveling in Miami and Florida. So yeah, I might have to go. Metman Master says, I'm sure if I tried playing Morrowind today, there would be a million little ways I'd find it a colossal pain in the ass compared to its sequels. But man, I'd love to play Morrowind again. Regardless, barely tapped the surface, but I love just how weird and alien the world is compared to the safer settings of Oblivion and Skyrim. And Robert Chesley 19 expressed disappointment with the podcast, but said, I understand the original Xbox wasn't the most popular console around, but I feel the games on it were great. No real mention of Jade Empire on the podcast was a shame. Oh, man, that's a really divisive one right there. Such an amazing game. Yeah, that's a really divisive statement. I know the 360 had its own share of hardware issues. Also, I think the Xbox stretched what the term RPG meant. I know it's not considered one in a traditional sense, but Steel Battalion with this great giant controller really took immersion with the title to a new place. I understand.
Every time my husband,
in the traditional sense of the word, there weren't many RPGs on the console, but I think there are a lot of quirky titles on the Xbox that had RPG-esque elements to them. As someone who was invested in Xbox first before the PS2 or GameCube, really, many of the RPGs that era that I played were Xbox titles. X-Men Legends 1 and 2, Dark Alliance 1 and 2, KOTOR 1 and 2. Anyways, I enjoyed the talk about KOTOR, and I understand the scope of this podcast doesn't lead to much talk of other parts of what made the Xbox great. Yeah, there's definitely a core of people who really love the original Xbox.
Yeah, and like I was saying, anytime my husband hears the word Steel Battalion, he's like, oh, I want that game, because he really, really likes the huge-ass controller setup.
I just like the fact that if you didn't hit the eject button, you would lose your save. That it would be...
Yeah.
And they had to flip open the thing and press the eject button. Amazing.
Yeah. Which is a really funny safety feature to have. I mean, I know it should be there, like, if we're talking about, like, an actual mech, because you don't want to accidentally hit the eject button, but, like, you miss those, like, extra seconds. But if you're on fire, like, do you have time to really flip up the thing and press it before you press the button?
I was more anti-Xbox than I should have been, and had back in the day. It definitely had its share of quirky and interesting games, and...
Yeah.
it actually holds up a little better than I thought, though I would contend that the PS2 holds up much better than the original Xbox.
Yeah, if I had to choose between the two consoles, I'd still go with PS2, but absolutely. I do really appreciate how Microsoft, it really elbowed its way in there. I mean, maybe that's kind of a weird thing to say about a multi-billion dollar corporation, but it pursued, it persisted, and no one really had any faith in the system, but it made its niche.
And finally, Kuninino has like a book-length comment about how Tales of Vesperia is probably the best Tales game. And was expressing frustration over how it got totally glossed over. Lesser games like Lost Odyssey and Blue Dragon got more time than probably the best JRPG to emerge from that generation. Whoa, hot take. Persona 4. Persona 4, my friend. Though I guess that's PS2. I don't know. Something better that came out in the 360 PS3 era that was better than Tales of Vesperia.
I never played Vesperia.
I am maybe blanking a little bit on a better RPG that came out at that time. I guess Persona 5 was technically PS3.
There you go. There's our answer.
But the people that actually played it were treated to a game that iterated on the classic JRPG formula to near perfection. You had a great cast, a big overworld, and a really good action battle system that had the depth of a decent fighting game. And then they just keep on going. So I recommend going and reading the comment in full. It's a little bit too long to read, but suffice it to say, they really like Vesperia and feel that it totally should get a whole bunch of attention. So, All right. Nadia, Axe of Blood God is a US Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Please subscribe. Do us a favor. You can find me on Twitter at @_Catbot. Nadia at Nadia Oxford. And we stream every Tuesday and Thursday on Twitch, twitch.tv/USGamerNet. Like us on all of the social media channels. If you like the podcast, do us a favor. Leave us a comment, and we would love to hear from you. We always love hearing from you, especially when the comments are positive. Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice.
Positive comments, they're great.
That should be a poster. Positive comments, they're great.
We do take constructive feedback as well. And if you want to send an email to us, drop us a line at usgamer@usgamer.net, and we may read your email on the show. Okay, we will be back, as always, next week to talk about more RPGs goodness. We're going to be talking about Pokemon Ultra Sun and Ultra Moon, which I get to blow through this weekend. Time to put aside Middle Earth Shadow of War, Nadia. I got to play some of that. Got to play some Star Wars Battlefront 2 single-player campaign. I'm going to be busy, busy.
Yeah, you got your weekend spoken for you here.
Yeah, I really do, but okay. We will be back, as always, next week. And for Nadia and myself, thanks for listening. Until next time, happy adventuring.